On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. On this week's podcast, we're going to be talking about the return of sectarian and religious persecution from Syria to the Congo, the rare languages facing extinction, and Gen Z's favourite aesthetic trend, Boom Boom.
With the fall of the Assad regime last year, there was a burst of optimism for Syria's future, and the new leadership made sure to make overtures to the West and gave guarantees that they would respect and protect the country's many religious and cultural minorities. This all appears rather to have been in vain with the news this week of hundreds of civilians massacred, mainly from the Alawite group. The Alawites are an ethno-religious Muslim minority, many of whom supported the Assad leadership. As Paul Wood writes in this week's magazine, reports suggest the killings were perpetrated by militias loyal to the new president, al-Jolani. Syria is also home to a small Christian community, one of the oldest in the world, which has fallen from 1.5 million people to just 300,000 since the start of the civil war in 2011. Given the violence the Alawites have faced, concerns have risen about the safety of this group, and Father Benedict Keeley asks in the magazine, can Christianity survive in the Middle East? Our cover image declares that there has been a massacre of the innocents, so is widespread sectarian persecution returning to the world? Paul and Father Benedict joined us to discuss. I started by asking Paul to outline what happened to the Alawites recently.
First of all, the why. There's a simple answer, which is that an Alawite rebel group attacked multiple police checkpoints and essentially tried to seize towns and villages. And then fighters that support the new government poured into Latakia. The more complicated answer is long-standing enmity between religious Sunnis and the Alawites. The religious Sunnis, the Islamists, think that they are not really proper Muslims. They're from a sect of Shia Islam, and some of their religious practices are secret to Alawites. And the association of many Alawites with the old regime. So you have this toxic brew of sectarian hatred, religious hatred. They're both sects of Islam. And a wish for political revenge. And as ever in these situations, it's in many conflicts I've covered, guerrilla army attacks and then withdraws, civilian population gets hit and suffers. That's exactly what's happened here. There have been shocking, awful stories, terrible videos. I talk about one of these videos in my piece. I couldn't get in much of the testimony into the piece. I spoke to many, many people, a man who'd been hiding behind a rock for days, and a woman who was disabled and her son was the only person to look after. She got down on her knees and literally begged the gunman not to kill her son. And exceptionally, they didn't. But in many, many cases, people shot in front of their wives and children, humiliated, made to make animal noises, crawl through the streets. Really an absolutely terrifying massacre, or many massacres. And people dead in the hundreds. We can talk about the exact casualties later, because as ever, situation is slightly confused, but just a horrific incidence of sectarian violence.
Mm. And Father Benedict, you also write for the magazine this week, a piece in which you ask whether Christianity can survive in the Middle East. And there is a Syrian phrase that you quote in your piece, which says, first the Alawites and then the Christians. So I wondered if you could start by perhaps explaining that a little for our listeners and a little bit about the persecution that Christian groups face in the region.
Well, as Paul said, it's principally an attack on the Alawites, who are considered heretics, basically, by Sunni Islam. So that's something that perhaps a lot of the media is not picking up on. They're focusing on them being associated with the Assad regime, but they're considered heretics. And so there's a particular violent hatred towards the Alawites, also though, and they call them sometimes little Christians, but added to that, for mainstream jihadists, Christians are also heretics, although they're people of the book. And so Christianity has been persecuted, as we know, basically from the start of Islam in greater or lesser degrees. But in recent years, since the uprising in 2011 with ISIS, both in Syria and in Iraq, the Christians suffered greatly, particularly in Iraq, but also in Syria, many massacres. But also Christians have felt, under the Assad regime, it's not about being an apologist of the Assad regime, but the fact is it was a secular republic. And so most religions lived in peace and relative harmony. Since that the fall of Assad, and but also during the war, wherever the Christians were, they were certainly second-class citizens, but also under usually great pressure. And so now there's this big question of what's going to happen to them. The first the Alawites, then the Christians thing has been said in a number of places, including in Lebanon. It basically means that they deal with the Alawites first, and then they move on to the Christians. I heard it said in a part of Lebanon as well that once they'd massacre the Alawites immediately, and then they'd move on to the Christians. So Christians are very, very nervous across the Middle East, but obviously in Syria at the moment.
And Paul, to what extent is the violence in Syria the responsibility of the new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who's the former militia leader known as al-Jolani, who has, as you write, links to al-Qaeda? Should he be considered responsible for some of this rise in violence across Syria?
He set the political tone. And we were just hearing about how unsafe the Christian community feels. I've covered violence against Christians in Syria going back over several years by ISIS and by other Islamists. And of course, Commander al-Jalali, as he once was the man who founded the al-Qaeda franchise, if you want to call it that, in Syria, fought with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the notorious head chopper of Iraq. But he's been on a journey, as they say. He has moved away from that ideology, has declared that he does not want to take the jihad outside Syria. He's an Islamist. He's a Salafist. He wants to go back to a purer, more Islamic way of living. And there has been reason for cautious optimism in that he's declared previously that Christians are safe. He's brought Christians into local government, first of all, in the north of Syria and into the national government to some extent. But when it comes to Alawites, it's different. I think there's just one single Alawite that he's recently appointed a few days ago as a liaison to the Alawite community. The rhetoric against Alawites has always been more harsh. So then the question is, after this uprising, attempted insurrection, which was not small, apparently 3,000 to 4,000 former regime soldiers and police officers joined it, according to one estimate, what did he do? Well, somebody who knows his thinking told me he wanted restraint. He knew there'd be a bloodbath. Others, including a man who lost many members of his family and I interviewed in the piece, say, well, he basically closed his eyes knowing what would happen. And if that's the case, if that's the interpretation, we're back to what has been called the Hama rules. Hama was the town destroyed by the Assad regime, flattened literally in 1982 as a warning. We don't play by the rules. If you rebel, expect no mercy, expect us to act outside the law. And he's an old militia commander, President al-Sharaa. You have to imagine he knew what would happen. In that case, are we back to the Hammer rules?
And Father Bendick, Colin Freeman also writes a piece in the magazine this week about the plight of Christians in the east of the Congo, where the other month a Islamic State-affiliated group has tightened its grip and 70 Christians were killed, beheaded, and their bodies were dumped in a church, an event which I must say was very underreported in the media here in the UK. Are we experiencing a new wave of global anti-Christian violence, do you think?
Well, surprise, surprise, it was underreported. Yes, Black Lives Matter, apparently, but not Black Christian lives. ISIS or its affiliates, ISIS is just a name, is growing exponentially across Africa. Nigeria last year, at least 5,000 Christians martyred, murdered, all across Africa, Mozambique. Yes, persecution of Christians, it may not be politically correct, but Christianity is the most persecuted religion in the world at the moment. Doesn't seem to matter to the mainstream media. It's out of out of their minds, really. It's not in being considered by them. And the church as well is also rather quiet about the persecution of Christians, particularly, for example, in China. So there are a lot of problems. Part of what I try and do is alert the world to the persecution of Christians. But Africa's just being ignored.
Why is it that you think the church is quiet about such instances of persecution?
Well, unfortunately, there's an attempt, which I think is not likely to be very successful, to have a dialogue with moderate Islam. I said this, in fact, to two, one a bishop in Iraq and also another senior figure in the Vatican. I said, can we have, what about dialogue with moderate Islam? And they both actually laughed and said, when moderate Islam exists, we'll have a dialogue. The problem is, of course, if moderate Islam existed, they would be in danger as well, those moderate Muslims. So I think the church is sometimes, or figures in the church, are rather naive. We can have great discussions and do great things together about things like the family or certain social issues, but certainly in terms of theological dialogue, that kind of thing is absolutely impossible with mainstream Islam. That's just a fact.
Paul, finally, the West is obviously often criticised for and is now quite wary of intervention in the Middle East. But what do you think Western allies and partners can do in the region to help protect these minorities? Is there anything that can be done?
Well, certainly not invade and occupy or fund armed groups. Diplomatic relations are slowly being opened with the new government. I think the Trump administration, which was always a bit suspicious of HTS, the main governing party now, the old Al-Qaeda group, which went on this journey we discussed. I don't think the US is going to do it, but Britain has lifted sanctions and is sending an aid package, a small aid package, but it's a start. So I think diplomatic pressure, President Ashara has received a lot of Western visitors who sort of politely and respectfully gloss over his past. I think unless he purges the ranks of some of the commanders of these units, unless he arrests the people who quite openly on video are carrying out these atrocities, then international engagement is going to grind to a halt and it will be the Syrian people that suffer. So I think the limited levers of power are financial, diplomatic, and publicising some of these atrocities. We do have to be careful. I don't think it is yet Christians in Latakia and other places. The Bishop of Homs, I think, said 12 had been killed. I've seen evidence that 3 have been killed. These are, and it's a terrible phrase, but the Bishop of Homs used it, collateral damage. Christians are not yet being targeted, but of course they must now be very fearful. It's bad enough that Alawites were massacred. This is a war crime, or a crime, if you don't want to call it a war crime. And the international community has to make some noise about it.
Paul and Father Benedict, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. Laura, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I'm going to go for Mary Wakefield's column. Mary has written before about how she is suspicious of cats, and she says she is still suspicious of cats, but nevertheless, she and her family have taken in a large grey kitten called George. She says that she understands now why people are so easily manipulated by cats and kittens, and she says that indeed her husband, Dominic Cummings, has been captured by this kitten and seems to be somewhat in love. So I would recommend that piece to our listeners. Will, what about you?
I particularly loved Matthew Dennison's piece about the crises that are facing the Norwegian royal family. Now, I must admit, the Norwegian royal family is not something I think much about, but I'm rather glad that Matthew drew my attention to this because it's quite an amazing, often tragicomic story. And frankly, it makes whatever problems our own royal family faces seem very small beer in comparison. Just before we move on to our next segment, I want to point out that this magazine also carries with it our school supplement, which runs twice a year in the magazine. And for this supplement, we asked some of our favourite writers what was the most insulting thing a teacher ever said to them at school. Well, our writers gave some absolutely brilliant, often very funny answers, and we can listen to a selection of them now from Matthew Paris, Stephen Fry, Rory Sutherland, Rachel Johnson, Philip Hensher, Sean Thomas, and Petronella Wyatt.
From the late Alan Lomberg, my English teacher at my school in Swaziland, in my school report, I'm sure I have only slightly less high an opinion of Matthew's literary abilities than he has himself.
An intellectual grasshopper is one that I remember from my German master. I don't know whether I earned the epithet or what it even means, to be honest. Another was, if he were truly as clever as he thinks he is, he would be the teacher, and I would have the pleasure of ignoring him as he ignores me. Ouch.
I regret to say I've chosen an easy target here. It was always games masters who are the most horrible. There's a strangely Darwinian streak to games masters. If a pupil is not academically or artistically gifted, most teachers will at least persevere and do their best. But sports teachers are genetic determinists to a man. From the first millisecond they discern you have no athletic or sporting talent, they would treat you as a complete idiot, a blot on the landscape, and were happy to abuse you for the merriment of everyone else. In the 1980s, poof, and for some reason, ponce-eared poof, were standard terms used by games masters to describe anyone who disliked organized games. So when one particularly nasty games master's son was flashed by a paedophile, most of us nerdy types saw it as karma in action, the natural justice of the universe reasserting itself.
When I was at the European school in Brussels, all the English children were in the same class at the beginning in the early 70s. I was therefore taught, age 7, with my older brother, whom our teacher, Mr. Black, considered gifted, but me, not so much. For homework one day, we were told to write an exciting story. I did my best, but when my English exercise book came back, Mr. Black had written, "Oh, how very boring, Rachel," at the end in thick, red felt-tip pen. I still try to bear that in mind whenever I write a sentence.
I still admire my English teacher who boldly gave the class The Wasteland. At 16, I was a mad Wagnerian. We got to the lines Eliot quotes from Tristan. I thought it would be iconoclastic to remark, "Of course, Isolde dies in the end of an orgasm." Mr. Buckley's timing was concise and impeccable. "Inconvenient," he said with a flick of a glance. As a put-down of weary experience, as if he had heard every conceivable teenage attempt to shock, it had the quality of making me feel he'd got my number.
My cruelest nickname came from a history teacher I liked, who innocently noted that my surname came from the Welsh Cornish ass equals son of Tom, Thomas. Gleefully, my schoolmates seized on this, and I very nearly became ass and then asshole forever. A fate I avoided by urgently thinking up nastier, more diverting nicknames for everyone else. Thus are writers born.
My maths teacher and I were standing in a classroom at St. Paul's Girls' School, which I attended back in the 1980s. I had just failed my maths O-level. "Petronella," he said, "you cannot get through life on charm alone." As I began to purr, he added, "Incidentally, that was an insult."
Next up, how good are you at languages? While the British might not be exactly famed for their linguistic ability, at least you could easily find someone to practice your French or your Spanish with. But what about if you spoke a Khoisan language from Southern Africa, or Durable from North Queensland, or even Cornish? Given these languages are all now listed as endangered, finding someone to chat with in them might be difficult. Harry Ritchie reviews Lorna Gibb's new book, Rare Tongues, The Secret Stories of Hidden Languages, in the book section of the magazine this week. Lorna takes us through the unstoppable process of language extinction that we're currently going through. Of the 7,000 languages currently spoken on the planet, only 500 will survive this century. And that was Dorothy Flores, Maria Avila and Christina Francois performing a song in the Garifuna language in Belize. Garifuna is a language spoken across Central America, which also faces endangerment, and is just one of the hundreds of languages focused on by the New York-based Endangered Language Alliance. So thank you to them for that clip. So what can be done to preserve and save our linguistic inheritance across the world? Harry joined the podcast alongside Dr. Oliver Mayo, a sociolinguist at the Faculty of Languages at Cambridge University, who also speaks Louisiana Creole. I started by asking Harry to outline some of the lesser-known languages mentioned in Lorna's book.
It was a really interesting book, actually, a kind of a whistle-stop tour around the world's endangered and exotic languages. Some of them were, most of them very well known to linguistics, but because linguistics is so rubbish at telling everyone outside the linguistics department about what's going on, it would be absolutely startling revelations to any lay person, including the whistling language, say, of Gomera, an island in the Canary Islands. If you whistle, you can get the noise travels 10 times as far as a shout. So in a Gomera, which has got isolated communities and mountainous areas and forests and everything which soaks up noise, they communicate by whistling. The whistling it kind of mimics the language, but also the whistles, the bits of the whistles incorporate grammatical features like, you know, pluralization and verb endings and things like that. Quite extraordinary.
And Oliver, you are a sociolinguist at Cambridge. And some of our listeners might, I suppose, think it's quite natural for languages to rise and fall. So given that the book that Harry's talking about is about endangered languages, why do you think it's important to preserve them?
Well, it's true that it's quite natural for languages to rise and fall, but only to a certain extent. And I think the interesting and important point about the rate of language endangerment today is that it exceeds what we've seen in the past. And it pertains to a kind of social situation which involves marginalized populations, minoritized populations, which results in a shift to a more dominant language. So really the importance of preserving or in working to revalorize and revitalize endangered languages links both to the question of those people's identities and restoring some kind of worth and giving some attention to those ways of being, those identities, but also to the inherent scientific value of these languages from the perspective of linguistics. So they contain phenomena which aren't documented in mainstream languages that we've all heard of, like French, for example.
And why is it the case that this problem of language extinction is so bad as it is at the moment? Is it simply a consequence of globalization, or what's going on here?
It is. We can talk about it as one consequence of globalization, but it's also a particular kind of globalization in the sense that it's related to the imposition of a dominant culture. So it's not just that the world is becoming more connected, but it's becoming more connected in a more hierarchical way. And that's sort of a natural outcome of any kind of contact between languages and cultures. But when you think about the fact that actually worldwide, the norm is to be multilingual, there's something quite unusual in this switch to monolingual societies that we see in the globalized world.
And the rate of extinction is amazing. At the moment, there are an estimated 7,000 languages being spoken on the planet. And by the end of the century, no matter what our best efforts, there will be 500 left.
Harry, did you get a sense of how Lorna Gibb went about researching this book? And then obviously how she then conveyed it to the reader. Presumably it's quite hard trying to convey lots of different languages to a reader.
Yeah, it's a very brave and commendable effort. As I say, any effort to kind of for linguistics to reach out to the general reading public is to be commended. She does a bit of travel metaphor and literal, a journey around the world's languages, but the people, she doesn't actually go there. I mean, it's a shame that publishers' budgets don't stretch that far, that she can go to North Queensland or Papua New Guinea, the hotbed of language endangerment. But no, she does it quite a few Zoom calls. She's quite open about that kind of thing. And her research is actually quite, not superficial, but it's not in-depth, but it doesn't need to be. There's just so much fascinating material out there that she can just kind of, cherry-pick the best, and it's comes across really well.
And Oliver, I believe that you speak a language, don't you, that is spoken today by fewer than 10,000 people. I wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit about it and maybe even speak a few sentences so we can hear an example of the sort of thing that you and Harry are talking about.
Ouais, moi, capable de dire un peu quelque chose en anglais. Moi, je peux parler un petit peu en créole. I do my research on Louisiana Creole, which is a language that came into existence as a result of the transatlantic slave trade, and was spoken as a lingua franca across what is now the state of Louisiana in the United States of America. And it's also my family background on my dad's side, although, as you can hear by my accent, I didn't grow up in Louisiana. So I started learning the language as a teenager. I'm kind of this very typical third generation who gets interested in the language of the grandparents. So that was in my grandparents' world, French and Creole. These were the languages that you spoke. By the time that my parents were born, this was a language which was seen as so bad that my grandfather said, if you want to speak it, you have to go outside of the house and speak it. And then us, the sort of third generation, we get interested again in this linguistic heritage, and some of us, maybe the most obsessive of us, get doomed to become academic linguists.
And so at its height, how many people would have spoken Louisiana Creole?
That's a really good question. I mean, there's probably something in the realm of almost 500,000, maybe even a million people would have spoken it across Louisiana in its heyday. Certainly, if you're counting French and Creole, then you're getting up to those numbers, yeah.
And Oliver, obviously languages are becoming extinct, but are new languages also being created? Is there kind of a natural kind of ebb and flow within the world of linguistics?
Yeah, that's kind of the other side of the globalization coin, is that in urban centers, particularly in places like West Africa, which are rapidly urbanizing, bringing people from many different linguistic backgrounds and putting them into a tight urban organization, new ways of speaking are coming into existence. And that's actually the same thing that happened, a similar process that occurred in the birth of Louisiana Creole, when so many people were taken from the West African coast as slaves, put into plantations, forced to work as usually in agriculture, and they did not have a common language apart from French. So there was a restructuring that occurred that brought into existence this new Creole language. So it's a very, very young language that's only been around for 300 years. And as we're speaking in other settings where there are many languages in contact, new ways of speaking are coming into being too.
And Harry, were there any languages that you read about when you were reviewing the book that you fancied taking up as a consequence? Any that had a particular appeal to you?
I have always wanted, you know, life's ambitions. I want to go to Brazil and I want to learn to speak with a click language. Mm. These are really popular in the sub-Saharan Africa. And it's the noises that you make, like, you know, that kind of noise. There's about 20 different kind of phonemes with clicks, and wouldn't it be great to be able to talk one of the Khoisan languages like that? It'd be great.
Harry and Oliver, thank you very much for joining. And finally, do you boom boom? Arabella Byrne asked this question in the magazine this week in her notes on, if you don't know what she's talking about, will you?
I barely do, I'm afraid.
Then you're forgiven, for as Arabella writes, boom boom is just the latest aesthetic trend. It was only coined at the end of last year. It's been made fashionable by Gen Z, and essentially what it is 1980s yuppies upgraded for 2025. So why is it popular? Arabella joined the podcast alongside the American trend analyst Sean Monahan, who not only coined the term boom boom, but also coined the term normcore in 2013. I started by asking Arabella to outline what boom boom is and when she first became aware of it.
So boom boom to me, and I'm aware that we have Sean here, so I don't want to step on his toes. Boom boom to me is a return to, as I see it, it's a return to a kind of 80s archival look that takes in structured suits. But for me, it takes in so much more than that. And I guess that's because I came to Boom Boom through New York Magazine. But it's really, it's so much the aesthetic of my late father. So I come to it not dispassionately. I come to it with great affection, I think, much more than I come to normcore.
Yeah. Well, so Sean, so for listeners who aren't aware, you coined both the terms boom boom and the term normcore. So can perhaps we should hear it from the horse's mouth. How did Arabella do? What is boom boom?
I think she's very close. I think when I was thinking of it, it's definitely all those style references. It's definitely a return to opulence, formality, hierarchy, tradition, all, like kind of infusing all these things into clothing. And I also think it's a certain sleaziness, maybe even that kind of surrounds unambiguous symbols of wealth, which, you know, as you brought up normcore is really about people avoiding that, right? It comes out of Silicon Valley, it comes out of new fortunes and people not wanting to look like they have new fortunes. So they keep dressing like they did in college, per se, in the case of Mark Zuckerberg.
And is the return then of Trump in a second administration and that kind of a 1980s New York real estate world that he inhabits, is that a factor in the rise of Boom Boom?
Absolutely. I'll say this. It occurred to me long before. I had an inkling. But what was interesting, you know, Paris Fashion Week just ended, and Mel Ottenberg, the editor of Interview Magazine, pointed out that the Saint Laurent show looked very 1987 Yves Saint Laurent. And also at the same time, the stock market is crashing, which also happened in 1987, the first time around. So there are there's a lot of historical rhyming going on.
Arabella, you talk in your piece about Gen Z particularly embracing this. I mean, I suppose it's nothing new that a younger generation tries to kind of usher in a new movement, but what is it about Boom Boom that particularly appeals to 20-somethings?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think we talk a lot about Gen Z, about how the traditional kind of signposts of adulthood are, you know, they're in delay for them. So they have children later, chances of owning a house are, you know, slimmer, and they've lived through digital revolutions where work and play aren't really demarcated. So I can see the appeal of dressing up in a kind of, you know, as a kind of dressing up box, sort of, I can be an adult now. And I think what I really like about Boom Boom is that it's the idea that your clothes tell a story, you know, that there's a provenance. So you kind of, your clothes tell a story about your provenance. And I think that normcore, it so destroyed that. And I found that to be...
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sean. I don't really want my boss to wear trainers. I just feel like, let's, you know, call it what it is. I think Sean, you've written about this a lot, but it's about how the, you know, the digital world has collapsed our sort of work and play distinctions. And so I think if we can sartorially build that up again, I see that as a good thing. But for Gen Z, you know, this is not tradition, it's nostalgia. And I wonder, Sean, maybe if you could talk about the difference between tradition and nostalgia, because Boom Boom is a nostalgia for a certain kind of costume, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nostalgia for a time period that Gen Z never experienced. When me and Arabella first spoke about this, I pointed out that in the United States especially, suiting is not common anymore. I think at best you get business casual in the office workplace. But most of the time you don't get anything. You just get, you know, jeans and trainers, as Arabella said. So I think this nostalgia for kind of a more formal, clearly defined workplace is like a stylistic kind of expression of people's difficulty with how ambiguous everything is. And something I pointed out in the original piece I wrote about Boom Boom also, I think people are also looking to kind of redefine what is work and what is play. And that has to do with some of this like renewed interest in things like golf, tennis. I mean, these are kind of classic high wasp sports in the United States, but they also have kind of a uniform to them in the same way that like a suit is a uniform for a workplace.
So is Boom Boom then, is it sort of a return to hierarchy in some sense as well, hierarchy and structure?
It's a desire for hierarchy and structure.
Right.
I mean, because I when I first wrote about it, the reason I put two booms in is because things are kind of falling apart for many people, but also other people are making huge fortunes. And that does feel very 80s in a lot of ways. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity when something like that's going on. I think, especially in the United States right now, no one has any idea what the hell's going on with the economy. So I think, you know, maybe dressing as if things make sense is a expression of that desire for things to make sense.
I guess a bit like putting on your bowler hat and going back into the city after the car.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, you know, dress to be the person that you want to be in the world. Fake it till you make it. Yeah, dress for the job you want.
Sean, just to finish, you're clearly very good at predicting and spotting trends. What comes after Boom Boom? I mean, dare you kind of...
It's too early.
Is it something very puritanical coming back down the line or even more extravagant?
I am not sure. I think this is something I started thinking about a couple years ago. And I do actually feel, you know, I was just in Paris during Fashion Week and it really felt spot on. You know, not to pat myself on the back too much. But I'm not sure what comes afterwards, frankly. I mean, there's, you know, the show I liked the most was Enfant Riche Déprimé, which has a very kind of post-punk glamour to it. And I think that that's kind of a corollary in a lot of ways to this 80s nostalgia. I pointed out that, you know, Patrick Bateman, the character from American Psycho, who's an inspiration, I think, for this kind of aesthetic, you know, he's doing cocaine in, like, you know, club kid places like Tunnel in 80s New York and at the Yale Club. I think there'll be a pushback against the new formalism. I think that's always how pendulum swings.
Didn't you call it, Sean, you called it patricidal, that like that these image cultures in the end, they kind of rise up and...
Absolutely. I think every time you have a new group of 20-year-olds coming up, they just absolutely hate whatever, you know, the 30-somethings, 40-somethings loved when they were young. And I think that's kind of natural because people want to put their own spin on things. People want to establish their own identity. And, you know, I mean, maybe millennials especially don't like to think of themselves as adults, but most of us are in or near our 40s now.
I'm a geriatric millennial.
Exactly. We've all become geriatric millennials.
This is how I define myself.
Some of us are still doing normcore, can you believe it? Sean and Arabella, thank you very much for joining.
And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed these discussions, please do pick up a copy of the magazine to read all the articles we've talked about in full. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please click the follow button be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we hope you join us again next week.